Salutations and shit, motherfuckers. Welcome back to another episode of Travel and Shit, your new favorite travel podcast, where we have more of an experiential conversation about what we have learned and why we're different people because of travel, as opposed to just focusing on the destination. I am your host, D. Carrie. Welcome back, motherfuckers that have been here before, and a bright, airy, sunny back in the studio. Welcome to all the new listeners. It feels good to be back with the little baby headphones on my child-sized head and with really adequate lighting again. As a poet, I mean, we all love the sun. I too love a good sun shine, but I just learned that those are, I want to say they're westward-facing windows. Or is that a south-facing? If that's south. It's an east, I think. It's an east-facing window that I was recording near. So it had good light, but it's better in here. So I'm happy to be back in the studio. Hopefully you can't hear the difference. Ooh, I tried, y'all. I tried my best with the audio. I tried my best with the visual. And alas, here we are. So I'm trying to think, are there any updates? Not really. Still merch, if you're interested, travelandshitpodcast.com. Still doing gift card giveaways for those of my plant parents that are interested in winning dollars to be spent at jordansjungle.net. I love buying plants from there. They arrive healthy, and in light of the current climate, he vocally supports Black Lives Matter directly, not just that whole diversity and inclusion. Hey, so I want to see myself personally, me, D, like seeing, hi, Black Lives Matter. That's what I'm here for. So it felt good to see someone that I enjoyed giving my money didn't question whether or not I deserve the same liberties that they possess. So there's that on that. Absolutely follow along with the social medias for the gift card giveaways. Oh, I have a mailing list, and that's how you win the $50 gift card. That is still open to be won. You can all get that info from _DCARRIE on Instagram for the most part. That's really where I spend all of my socials, because social media is very draining for me. I am, takes a lot to come up with something to post in terms of words and visuals. It's for me, it's easier to just focus on one or the other. I either focus on the words or the visual, and combining the two is just, it's not fun. I don't really like it. All right. So I do it sparingly. That being said, this week is a really fun episode that I've been looking forward to, because this is my first follow-up episode. This is the first time I'm having a guest back on for a second time. Hey! Anika, welcome back. Thank you for joining me. For those of you who are not new to the show, I did an episode with Anika. Let's pull it up. Let me tell you guys what episode it
almost
was.
Almost a year ago. About a year ago. Wow.
Episode descriptions. Let's see. I'll put it in the description notes, of course. And I can only see a quarter of it, so I don't record the screen. But I'll put it in the notes. I feel like it was in the 40s, right? Episode 40-something. That was Mickey. You came before Mickey, so let's travel. I can't see it, y'all, because I'm recording the screen. But that was a good time. So update the people. What's new for you?
Well, I'm obviously back in New York.
Because, welcome.
thank you. Because of, you know, the pandemic. So I actually left Barcelona on March 16th. Mm. And then I arrived in New York the same day because of the time difference. So I've been back for about 3 months and happy to be back. Love New York. It's my home. Love Brooklyn, obviously. So what is new? Well, I moved to Barcelona. Anyone who tuned into the episode that we did before knows that that was the trajectory that I was going for. Started dental school. and it's hard, first of all. So if any of you are thinking about becoming doctors, yes, it's hard. Definitely struggled a lot throughout my first semester of dental school. Some with the work, with the you know, the course load and the courses themselves, but more so just with the environment. So just to explain a bit about how higher education works in Spain and probably for most of Europe, to be honest with you. When you go to university and you want to become, you know, you want to go into your profession, doctor, lawyer, dentist, nurse, you do that straight out of high school, opposed to in America where you go and you get an undergraduate degree first and then you apply for a school in those professions. So the first issue is that I am in school with 18 and 19 year olds, the oldest maybe being about 24. I am 33. I'm a bit of a late bloomer, but that's okay.
On time bloomer, because everyone's bloom is different. I want to say that it was probably something along, well, I think it was Miley Teal that said it. I personally love Miley for many reasons, but one of the things that she makes note of is that she doesn't really care for when people refer to her as like a late bloomer, because everyone's life is supposed to happen in their own time. Like, just because it didn't hit like that social norm or the social trajectory, like, not having kids at 22. So if you have kids at 42, you're a late bloomer, but it happens when it happens for you. So yeah, you weren't, you know, the 21-year-old, the 20-year-old in the class, no. But you know, you was there when you were supposed to be there.
I was, you know, and I definitely, I believe in that. My mom used to say, listen, honey, Mamanique, she used to call me Mamanique, things happen when they're supposed to happen. So I'm okay with that. At different points throughout the semester, I really struggled with being the oldest person in the class, because I feel like I'm so far removed from college and grad school. It's been a long time since I've been in school, and so getting back into the mode of studying, whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was a big hurdle to overcome, but you know, it is what it is. When you have a goal, you have a goal. The second thing is I was one of two Americans. There, Americans just don't go abroad to go to school for whatever reason. And I was probably one of five people of color. So,
now how large was the class overall?
So in my year, there are 52 students, and I'm actually the only Black person.
Okay.
And then I've seen a couple of Black people around school. I assume that they're probably from France, because there are a lot of French students in my university. And I don't know if they're in the dental program or if they're in medical school or nursing or pathology, but I can count on one hand how many I've seen. And for some people of color, because obviously we're not a monolith and I don't want to put us all in the same category, but for some of us, that could be an issue, just not having a space where you can just freely be Black. So that was actually the biggest hurdle that I was really trying to overcome, because I can't say that I've actually done it, because I came home in the middle of the second semester, but that was the biggest struggle for me, was finding a community of like-minded Black people who had similar outlooks that I did, because I was meeting a lot of Black people, but they had very different ideas of Blackness, and that's okay, but right. It made it a lot more frustrating.
To find your tribe, to find your
exactly,
community.
Exactly, especially when they weren't, in school where I'm spending, or in the library where I'm spending a majority of my time.
And I think it's important to note that it's not your first rodeo with being the first woman of color abroad. Because in our first conversation we had, we discussed your experience teaching abroad. So how would you say the two experience kind of differed or compared to each other, besides the, you know, being on the opposite end of education in terms of, you know, you were there to teach the first time around and this time being the one, you know, absorbing the education. Well, I mean, in both instances, you get what I'm saying. Like you, right. Even as a teacher, I feel like the better teachers are able to learn from their students and then, you know, in turn use that to teach the students. Right. But this time being the student, how would you say the experience differed? Because you've experienced it, but I'm assuming that there was something about this experience in being different was different from your first time going through it.
Definitely my time in Barcelona felt extremely different from my time in South Korea. I will say that was an aspect, being a teacher opposed to being taught, definitely a very different space to be in. But I think the level of awareness and consciousness that I have around being a person of color is very different now at 33 than it was at 23. Mm-hmm. And I think that I have a very different, outlook. Now, I don't want to say very different. I have a more evolved outlook on what it means to be a person of color in a space where there are no people of color. You know, at 23, I was not particularly aware of the ways that I had to be malleable to fit into those spaces, or the ways that I had to be presentable, or, you know, the kind of the daily act that we do in order to be perceived a certain way in spaces. I'm not sure that I was aware of that at 23, 24, but now a decade later, I'm extremely aware of that and a bit exhausted with it, to be quite honest with you. And that's where a lot of my frustration came from in Barcelona. And that was the text that we were having when I text you back in March. And I'm like, okay, we need to talk about this, because I don't know if I'm sure a lot of travel people are talking about it, bloggers. But this is a very unique experience. I think being a Black woman, being about a decade to 15 years older than everyone that I'm in school with, and then being the only me that's there, definitely, I want to say, created a lot of frustration. Definitely.
So how did it, like, because before I interrupted you, before, sorry.
It's okay.
You were mentioning that the Black people that you were finding weren't exactly there for the same reasons you were there. You were there as a student, so you spent a lot of time in the library and in other, I would assume student-centric spaces. So What was it for you that made the difference in discomfort this time around?
I would say that a large portion, well, firstly, most of the Black people that I was meeting in Barcelona, have met in Barcelona, are women primarily. I have not met too many Black men, and that's not to say that Black men don't travel and live abroad, but I just assume this was my same experience in South Korea, so I'm under the assumption that maybe we just live abroad a little more, but don't quote me on that because I don't have stats on that. So most of the Black people I'm meeting are women, and a lot of them were there, and this is by their own testimony, just because either they felt unseen in America, or they felt unheard, or they, you know, they couldn't find love, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And the desire, they had this deeply rooted desire to just pack up and go somewhere and experience life in a different way, and maybe be viewed in a different way and have different opportunities for finding relationships or creating connections. And I think the difference for me is that was never my goal going into that space. It's not like I really, 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 deep down in my heart, wanted to move to Barcelona. What I really, really wanted to do was not be in $500,000 of debt after dental school. And that's where America would have had me. And so my primary goal going there is like, listen, I'm going to school. I'm going to get this done. Of course, I'll enjoy while I'm there and I'll travel, because why not? But I don't have the same outlook. I don't feel unseen, unheard, and all of those things. But I must acknowledge, and I would be remiss not to acknowledge, that as a woman of color who a light-skinned woman of color, it's a very different experience from someone who's brown or dark skin. And I, you know, as a woman of color, you have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge that our experiences are different. And, you know, the things that the world says about us is very different. Mm-hmm. So some of my frustrations were coming out of that, because there's a very, apologist kind of underlying tone with those women that I was experiencing in Barcelona. And that was very frustrating.
How so?
Well, a lot of times when I would, let's backtrack, going into a space as a Black woman with other Black women, you're looking for a safe space, for a space to voice your concerns, your opinions, your feelings, your thoughts about what you're experiencing. And because there's not an abundance of us in this space, we expect to be able to have that opportunity to voice those things. And so going into spaces with some of these women voicing these concerns, there would be a lot of, well, what did you do to make that happen? Or what did he say? Or what was that? It was always such a, just like an apologist, like, oh, but it's not that bad. Like, I'm okay with not having other Black people to be around. And that's okay. Cause again, we're not a monolith. We don't all feel the same way about it, but it was frustrating for me. It was frustrating.
So the Black people that you did meet, how were you meeting them? Like, did you look for expat social groups, or were you like making friends on social media or different like apps and saying, okay, well, like were you looking to engage in meetups, or were you just like running into people at the grocery store and, you know, striking up conversations and such that way?
So the first girl I met, I was actually in a grocery store, and I was like, she's Black, but I know she's American. Like, I could feel it. Mm-hmm. So I walked up to her and I was like, are you American? And she was like, yeah, I'm from Philly. Blah, blah, blah. So she was real cool. We're actually still really good friends. And she actually introduced me to a social group, Las Mujeres de Barcelona. Mm-hmm. Las Morenas de Barcelona. So mm-hmm. she introduced me to that group. And then within that group, I started to meet up with people individually. And I never really felt connected to anyone in that group. And it was always pretty much for the same reason. I just always felt like we weren't on the same wavelength when it came to what I needed. Like mm-hmm. I needed a somewhere safe to be like, listen, I am tired of talking and saying all the syllables. I am tired of having to smile and look happy. I am tired of trying to make these white folks feel comfortable. Cause honey, I just want to talk the way I talk. and that you can't, not that you can't do that every day. Of course you can, you have a choice, but in order to be more palatable to a certain group of people, we tend to not do that. And a lot of times voicing those, you know, those opinions and concerns, it'd be like, but it's not that bad. Like, you know, you have to be presentable. That's the only way we're going to get ahead. And I'm like, child, like you have no idea, honey. That is not it. First of all, you lying. Second of all, stop.
Right. I had to kind of, it's respectability politics. I hate it across the board just because it doesn't work. And it's one of those things that I had to come to where I saw it the most was with my grandparents. Mm. And I would get so fired up. Like, I'd get in my bag to defend, like, a lot of the sentiments that they were expressing that they believed in. And where when I disagreed, it was just like, no, but here's why. And then I would ask questions. And I would try to, like, dig into certain things with them or give them my reasons to why I believe certain things that they believe just, like, weren't the case. And right. with them, they have the unique difference that, for them, they had to do these things in order to stay alive, like, physically, like I can't like walk survive, on this. Yeah. Right. So it's like I had to let go of being angry at them for thinking these things because it's like we live totally separate lives. You know what I mean? Where it's just like, so I had to kind of like internalize that and then you know, speak more from love as opposed to speaking from hurt in when I would disagree with them. Now, in terms of people that are, in my mind, on a, I don't want to say a more equal playing field, because again, monoliths, like it's just not the way it works. Like, depending on where you're from in terms of geographically, like, are you American? Are you from a different country? What is your experience in those places? Like, do you experience them from like your work? Is this, are you speaking to me from your lens of work, or are you speaking to me from your lens of personal life? I think that in a lot of social interactions, when we're discussing with our peers, if you will, regardless of what stage of peer it is, whether or not you're my peer because we look alike in a space where that is a very easily identifiable quality, or in terms of the workplace or in school, we're in the same major or whatever. All those things being said, I 100% agree with the, how do you not see it this way? Like, what is it? What has your life been that you don't get it? And I would love for, like, I, that's one thing that it never really connects for me, that someone that has had the same luxuries as I've had in terms of just being in this era of time. That's more what I want to point out, because even though we all are in this era together, in terms of like the 18 to 40 demographic, I mean, like, you know, people we would find ourselves being friends with, if you will. We can live different lives and be from different areas, but we've seen the same things along the same timeline. So it is baffling to me where you can't, when people can't step outside of their own experience and see why certain viewpoints and ways of thinking are problematic. And because we're in this same, again, era of space where, again, not holding socioeconomic things against anyone, right? Like, we all, assuming we have equal access to the internet, assuming we have equal access to not worrying about where our next meal comes from, assuming we have equal access to not being concerned with where we're living. And that's what I mean by peers. It's like we're in a very similar playing field where we're not worried about certain things. So it's like, okay, with all of this at your disposal, with all of this time or with this luxury of disposable income, like, how do you still feel so, like, in my mind, I wouldn't say backwards, but I don't want to be the judgy person. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's like my grandparents had their reasons. Like, they had to, you know, they wanted to be able to live to be grandparents. But for someone that doesn't have to come from that space, it's very more, it's a different type of frustration.
It's so deeply frustrating. I can't even articulate into enough words how frustrating it is to hear another Black person talking bullshit, like, to be honest with you, just talking nonsense, like, no, but it's not like that. We just have to work really hard and pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and we all have the same 24 hours in a day, and we all get the same opportunities. If that were true, things would be very different, but that is not true, and it never has been. And to hear other Black women in a foreign country, in a part of the world where people throw bananas at Black soccer players, to hear them say something like, well, Black people, basically, essentially what they're saying is, well, Black people are just lazy. That's why they haven't gotten where they need to be. To hear you allude to that and to buy into the rhetoric, and it is just supremely frustrating. And I've also realized that those are people that I absolutely cannot align myself with, because we're never going to see eye to eye, and you're absolutely never going to understand why I do the things that I do and why I live the way I live, why I will pick up the phone and call a place and ask them if it's a Black owned business, or why I'm trying, in the work that I'm trying to do, I'm only trying to employ Black and brown people. Like, you'll never understand why And if you want to live in a bubble where none of this matters to you, then that's fine. That is absolutely fine. But you cannot expect other people to hold those same false virtues, because it's false. What you believe in is actually false. And I feel like there's enough evidence, and there's enough statistics. There's just more than enough to show that that way of thinking is, there's nothing to support it.
Right.
So.
So where on the spectrum did you find yourself in those situations in terms of the revolutionary mindset, if you will? I've realized I'm not an educator. I don't have the patience, and I also don't feel as if I possess the statistics, the facts, and the scope of vocabulary that I would want to impart on someone, or I'd want to leave someone with, in terms of not arguing them down in a sense of my ideas are better than yours, but I don't feel like I have the capacity to have the kind of conversations I think people would need in order to see the error in their ways, if you will. So I'm not an educator. I don't necessarily have that patience and that time to sit and explain to people why they're wrong. I do, however, find that I am a nurturer. I'm a lover. I would much rather spend my time and energy and whatever resources I am to give to the movement to make sure that my people and people that look like me are okay. How can I help you? How can I make your day easier? What can I do that is going to support you in where you're trying to get? That is, for me, my role. So did you see how, or did you see a change, if any, in how you were showing up, if you will, in that space of Blackness, I guess you can say, any differently? Because it's one thing to feel that way at home, right? And it's another thing to now see yourself in a space that's your new home. But it's like, did it feel like a temporary home? Let me start there.
I have no intentions of staying in Barcelona past dental school. I mean, if I find somewhere else in Europe to do a residency, then I'll do that. But the likelihood of me coming back to New York to finish up is very high. And it's not because Barcelona is a terrible place. Barcelona is beautiful. I would tell anyone, if they're looking to visit, wine, phenomenal, cheese, great, all of those things. But for living, I personally didn't enjoy the time. And I know that I have years of school left. But for me, in my mind, the way I set it up was like, I kind of just go to school in Barcelona. It's as if I go to school in Canada. You know what I mean? It's just somewhere I fly home 7 hours and I'm done. It never felt like home. It never felt like anywhere where I was going to put down roots, because the types of things that I enjoy doing, the type of people I enjoy being around, the conversations that I want to have, the things that I want to do, the spaces that I want to be in, they don't really exist in the amount that I would like them to exist in Barcelona. There's little pockets, but I want to be, I don't know. And I think part of it is just coming from Brooklyn, spending a lot of time here, you know, spending a lot of time in Best Eye and Philly and Baltimore, and just, you know, knowing that there are Black creative spaces and there are just Black spaces where we can just be. We don't even have to be there being creative. We don't have to be there doing nothing. We can just be. There's other people. We can just take off the mask and just be comfortable. And I feel like it was very difficult to find those spaces. So no, it never felt like a home or anywhere that I wanted to be home.
Do you feel like that sense of temporary displacement being there affected how you were able to take in the personalities you were interacting with?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because there were a lot of people who did feel like, yeah, this is the last stop on the train for me. Like, I love it here. And I'm like, oh, okay, you know, and it was always like, well, why don't you there was always this feeling of like, what's wrong with you that you don't love this place? And I'm like, no, nothing is wrong. It's just not somewhere where I love. Now, before I came back, the weekend before I came back, I went to London.
Okay.
A vibe. Okay. A whole vibe. I was like, what? Why didn't I go to school here? But because it's the same price as America.
Right.
But I was like, yes, this is amazing. And so I just feel like, yeah, London had the vibe. Barcelona just doesn't have the vibe that I'm looking for. Maybe that's just what it is. It's just not a vibe.
Okay. Period. I think that people tend to not consider energy as much as they could benefit from. If a lot of people, it's kind of like when you are looking for a new apartment, they always tell you, make sure that you check out the area during the nighttime so you can see what the evening energy is like. And, you know, do you feel safe walking home at night? Blah, blah, blah. Like those kind of things. And I don't think that, I guess it's also attributed to luxury. If you are going to embark on foreign study or expat life to whatever extent, if you don't go check out the area beforehand, it's like, or if you don't vacation there before, and then also vacationing in the space and then moving to a space are also very totally different. It's like, right. There's a different set, or I guess a different feeling of short-termness where you can easily kind of brush certain things off because it's like you see the deadline and the deadline is so much closer. And also I think that as many of us try to be as culturally immersive as we can when we travel, there's still a difference in if you're not in, for example, I don't necessarily see my trips as vacations as much as I see them as just like little pockets of time just spent someplace else. But right. I also see the short termness in
right.
a temper. Like, I'm not here to do nothing important. You know what I mean? I think right. that's the difference right. I'm trying to make. Like, I'm here bullshit. Right. When it comes right. down to it, there's absolutely nothing that I'm doing that is, what's the word?
It's a necessity.
Yes. There's nothing right. essential happening here. This is still very right. luxury and vacation of me, even though I don't necessarily view it as a vacation. Whereas if you're here right. to work, if you're here for school, if you're here for, you know, what do you call it? Time with your family. It's right. a completely different experience in how you take in the way you're responded to and how you take in the way that you're interacted with, because it's much easier to just dismiss something when you know that you can pick up and go someplace else. But exactly. if you know that there is some type of restriction on when you can move and how you can move, I feel like there's automatically going to be another level of how you absorb what's happening around you.
So absolutely.
Can you point to any experiences in particular that stood out as really, I don't want to say pivotal, but I guess you can say that stood out as representative of the type of experience you had?
I would say that... Or an experience, okay, one experience that is really hard to say because I think there's a culmination of a combination of things that culminated in the feeling that I feel or felt during my time there. To be honest, I never felt like I never experienced overt racism or anything like that. So that's not what I'm suggesting at all. I'm just suggesting that the type of spaces where some Black people need to just feel comfortable, let go and take off the mask. There are not a lot of spaces that exist like that. And I think if I had to speak to one experience, it would be being the only Black person in a class of 52 people. That is like, yeah, and having people ask me ridiculous fucking questions about, like, oh my God, I have actually a great example. So I have an Italian young man in my course whose name will be left unsaid, and he is a young man of maybe 19 or 20, And his grandfather is Black, which he let me know because for some reason that was very important to let me know. So he, one day I'm walking out the library and he's like, all right, see you later, my nigga. And I'm like, what? I was like, you can't say that. And he's like, yeah, no, I can't. I'm Black. I was like, and then he proceeds, this is how I found out he was Black, actually. He proceeds to go to his phone and pull up a picture of his grandfather, who's like some kind of pianist or maybe a trumpeter. I don't know. And I was like, listen, you actually can't say that. And while I didn't feel like racially attacked at all, right, like in that situation, the ignorance around what that actually is and how, like, just the whole ignorance around the situation, about saying the word, about being Black enough to say the word, understanding the politics of being a person of color. It's just that. And I think that is a very, I think it's a poignant experience and it's representative of exactly what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You know, I could choose to be an educator in that moment and go into an entire, you know, soliloquy about why that's not okay. But to be honest with you, I feel like my words would fall on deaf ears. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my effort would be wasted. And I have, that is something that I've come to realize throughout, you know, my time in Barcelona and experiencing these different types of Blacks, Black people, different type of Black people, is that, well, one, understanding we're not a monolith and we don't all feel the same way about everything. And two, knowing that as much as I want to educate and as good as I am at it, it's not always going to be received because people are just are where they are in their experience. And if your life experience has led you to believe that this is the way things are structured and you can't possibly see it from my viewpoint, then I have to allow you to be into that space until something tells you otherwise. Right. And now, since we are in this entire Black Lives Matter movement, to be honest with you, I feel justified and vindicated in everything that I've been saying. Like, I've been telling y'all. And now, look, and now the whole world believes it. And I'm like, you, and I'm looking on Instagram and I'm like, you the same girl that was like, Black people need to stop bitching and complaining. And now you all Black Lives Matter. But you know what? It's all right. Because people are allowed to evolve.
Yes. Okay. We're allowed to grow. And it's kind of, and it's the sucky part about this is that you want to believe that so many people are well-intentioned, right? You want to believe that so many people actually believe the things that mm-hmm. they're saying during this time in their space of support, in allyship, and even in experience, right? Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I don't care what you look like. It's one of those things where do you feel justified in feeling a way about people bandwagoning? You know what I mean? It's just like,
yeah, of course. Yes. Yes. That is not okay. That is not okay. The reason that it's not okay is because this is a real problem and it needs real solutions and it needs people who are really committed to action. It's because action produces the type of results that we need to get what we are asking for. And if you're just jumping on the bandwagon because you are Black, but you don't even really believe this, then that's a problem. That is a huge problem because actually you're not an ally.
So now my question is, what if their action, whether they believe it or not, produces results? Desired results. Because that's where my conflict is, right? Where it's like, it's one of those things where I try not to be judgy, right? Because when, because it's, okay, I feel like I've encapsulated how I want to present it. If you say, I've been talking about, let me use A-Marie, for example, because I stand for A-Marie. I love A-Marie's music, right? So I've been saying since All I Have that A-Marie is fucking phenomenal. I've been saying it, I've been saying it, and I've been saying it. Now all of a sudden, she's on a Beyonce track, and now they're 47 million more people that jump on her dick and are like, oh, A. Marie is the best. Oh my God, she's so good. I've been, and it's just like, all right, well, I was saying it before and you weren't agreeing with me, but she wins the Grammy. So it's like, damn, I've been saying this all this time. And now that this person says it and now everybody else is jumping on it, but I feel a way because y'all ain't believe it before, but the results that happen are my fave is recognized. And now that she's got this behind her, the price goes up and now her work is spreading even further and she's able to more easily support her family. She's more, you know, her creativity and her voice gets amplified. And so all these amazing things happen. So it's kind of like, damn, do I really, should I feel a way about the people that jumped on when they did? Now, is it to say that everybody that jumped on when they did didn't necessarily believe that she was, you know, that incredible? Or is it that because, you know what I mean? Then it's just like you've got that subset, the subsect of people that are saying that this is a good thing because of the energy around it, the Beyonce effect, if you will. You see what I'm saying? So, and that's kind of, but it's like, it, look how much came of it. Look how much more we got. I got 4 new studio albums and she's now touring in more areas. So I can see her perform live more and I'm getting more content. So it's like, I love the results, but am I really upset about the people that got on late, even if some of them meant it, some of them didn't mean it, and some of them were just kind of, you know what I mean? Like, you've got all these different types of people that jumped into it midstream, and...
Well, I feel like what I will say to that is, I get the analogy, but the difference is that with A. Marie and Beyonce, music is instant, and success in music is instant. With our fight, it is a long-term battle. It is not something that's going to happen with 3 or 4 weeks of protesting. It's not something that's going to happen with, you know, posting squares on Instagram or, you know, having little
Zoom Juneteenth conferences.
Yeah, little conferences and Zoom and Juneteenth. Those are all great things. And I'm not trying to downplay what they're doing, because they're all necessary, and it's necessary to, in order for things to change, we need to bring awareness, you know, we need to elevate awareness around it so that more people can know about it and so that people can make decisions about where they stand on it and how they are going to approach solving the problem. The problem with people who jump on the bandwagon, and I'm not saying you shouldn't, again, people are allowed to evolve. If you evolve, if you never knew, there was a time where I didn't know this. There was a time where I didn't understand. I just said it. When I was 23 and I went to Korea, I wasn't really aware of the subtle nuances of being Black. And it was only as I evolved and I became more educated and I started reading and understanding things that I now have a more evolved viewpoint on what it means to be a woman of color. And what I will say is that everybody who jumps on the bandwagon is not fake. Some people are evolving. Some people are leveling up their awareness and their consciousness. And that is amazing, because those people will be the people who will carry on the fight and the revolution. But people who are just jumping on it because it is a look, it's the trending thing to do, it's trending, they are not going to be a part of the pivotal change. They may have protested, they may have stood outside, they may have made it look good for now. But we are thinking, what about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15, 20? What about our children, our children's children? That is going to be the difference between those who mean it and those who don't mean it. And by no means am I saying, oh, I've been saying this forever and now you're just finding out. What I'm saying is, I've been saying this forever, you've been telling me no, and now it's trendy. And now you want to either, you've either realized what I was saying was right, or you realize that you need to look good. Either way, it's problematic. So my thing is, I'm really appreciative and I love what's happening now. And I think the movement is amazing because, again, we're raising awareness around issues that even our own people may not have known existed. And there's power in numbers. And we will you know, get far having the numbers that we need to have. But again, we need people who are committed to committed action, who are dedicated to sustainability and sustainable action, long-term sustainable action. And that's all, you know, that's all I mean about I feel justified and vindicated, because now you see that I'm not just a crazy revolutionary that's been saying wild shit because I'm angry.
Right.
It's a real
right,
thing.
Right, right, right. That anger part is key, because a lot of people just take it as, oh, she's just upset about something that happened. It's like, well, why aren't you upset? Why aren't you upset? Right. And I don't have to always speak from a place of upset in telling you why something is wrong. Sometimes I'm just actually stating that this is a problem. This has always been a problem. And it does. Right. And I feel like people try to, I don't want to say throw emotion, but guilt you for being emotional about something that you are within your human rights to be, like, in your logical emotional human about, rights, like, right? Like, your existence and your safety is something that anybody with sense would be emotional about. And right. Special shout out to those of you whom can take a step back from emotions and use your words to effectuate change in the mindsets of other emotional people. Because I haven't evolved to that. Like, I know I personally don't do well with stepping outside of my ego and stepping outside of feelings. And I mm-hmm. was one of my friends. I am the block, cancel, unfriend, delete queen in terms of Facebook. Like, since I got employed by my employer, I have systematically taken every couple of days a scroll through the list of suggested friends and, you know, related friends to block, 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 just because a lot of the people in the industry that I work in are very toxic. So I don't interact the two. I feel like there may be seven people that I work with in some capacity that I actually have on, especially Facebook, just because Facebook is, that's for the family. You know what I mean? You're posting right. pictures with you and your grandma and your grandpa and stuff. Whereas on Instagram, that, at least for me, that's, you know, I don't do the same. And it's a little bit more difficult sometimes, because with a public profile, it's, but so much you can keep other, like, if they look for me and find me, that's one thing, but I try to make it as difficult for them to do on the Facebook at that. But that being said, right. I had a friend that, took his time and engaged with a lot of people on a mutual friend's post that they had put on Facebook. And I had, when I saw him mm-hmm. in person, I had to be like, yo, bruh, you got it. Like, you very succinctly and clearly, like, expressed what was going on and cleared up some things that people tried to debate him on. And, like, I know I can't do that. That's not my part of the, it's not in my ministry booklet. It's right. not there for me. So I appreciate those people that can do it. But outside of the social aspect of your experience in school, how did you think your teachers perceived you? Like, how was that exchange?
Yeah, most of my professors seem pretty, they were pretty okay. I mean, I had an issue with one professor that I had to escalate. But besides that, I think that for the most part, I had okay experiences with my professors. They don't seem, it's very different. I like from going to school here, I feel like here I developed more of a relationship with my professors. Some of them were even mentors to me and guided me. When I was in grad school, I had the chairman of the department who was, I mean, he was an amazing, just like mentor in that space, that I was struggling with in the beginning. And then, you know, with his, leadership and guidance, just ended up excelling in. And, it's not like that. It's not like that in Europe. And it's not just because, you know, oftentimes I'm like, is it because I'm detached or removed? But no, it's just a very different experience. It's a very much hands-off kind of educational experience. Yeah. And it's kind of strange, to be honest with you. It's very much so about how you can lead and guide yourself in school. So I'm trying to think back to my professors from last semester, and it seemed like so long ago, and it wasn't that long ago, but I just can't even remember. I just remember the head and neck anatomy professor that I had an issue with, about grading, and everyone else was pretty, I had a British professor who was pretty cool. Yeah, everybody was cool this last semester. I mean, I only got to experience my professors for a month and a half. And then after that, everything was online, but they were okay. I think the one of my professors I did have somewhat of a relationship with, and he was very interested to know why I came all the way to Spain to go to school. And then he was like, "You're a little bit older than everybody else." And I was like, "Yeah, a little." He's like, "What, like 26? I was like, "I'll take it."
Right.
Right. I'll take it. Right. And I'm like, "No, sir, I'm like 50. But yeah, for the most part, I think my professors perceive me as just a non-traditional student. And that was it. I know that in the beginning, I was really trying to get an understanding of how things work. And I was emailing people right and left all the time, because Spain has a very mañana mentality. Everything is, oh, mañana, mañana, tomorrow, tomorrow, you know. Oh. And I'm like, sir, I need a syllabus. I need guidance. I need to understand dates. I want them in advance. I like to plan. And right. They're just not about that, like, especially in Barcelona. And that is where a lot of the, you know what, we don't like this American bossy ass bitch came from, because I was like, what is this lack of organization? And also because I'm an adult and I've already been in adult spaces doing adult things, you know, managing properties and doing all these different things. And it's like, I need, you know, you're with 19-year-olds who have nothing else to do except go to school and drink all weekend. I'm like, I am running a business all the way in America. I need you to give me deadlines because I got shit to do. So, and not like 3 days before. So right. I had a little bit of trouble in that space. But I've learned how to manage this now. So, yeah, I think my professors were, I think they were okay.
Okay. What kind of living situation did you have? Did you, like, rent your own space? Did you do Airbnb? Or were you, like, on school housing or something?
So that's another thing that doesn't exist in Spain. I'm not sure about the rest of Europe, but they do not have dorms or school housing or campuses or anything like that. So most students who come from abroad to go to school just rent an apartment, or they live in like a shared housing, okay. which is kind of like a dorm, but it's not owned by the school.
Got it.
So, I had an apartment because I have my dog and I took her with me, and I was like, Diamond girl, we got to live alone.
And Diamond's a pit, by the way. So Diamond's yes. not a cute little, you know, teacup Yorkie or something right. that she threw under the seat on the flight right. over there.
Right. there right. was Diamond is a whole, right. She's a whole 50-pound pit bull who I'm looking at right now. She's sleeping. And she, you know, taking her there, I was like, yeah, I need my own space. Cause I don't know, like, I'm just very anal about cleaning and dog fur and all types of things. So I just got my own apartment.
Okay. So what's the business that you run? What kind of business were you running from abroad?
So I own property and I was doing short-term rentals up until coronavirus and basically buying, selling, not flipping, because ain't nobody got time for that. But shout out to the flippers though, because that is a lot of work. So basically just buying, renting, owning, holding, things like that. And trying to put those systems in place effectively while I was gone was also yet another challenge. Mm-hmm. But everything, you know, everything worked out. So that's basically what I was doing.
So while you were in Spain for this beginning of COVID, how was it handled there? Like, what was your experience like in terms of being in the student experience because of the way they may have handled it with your classes? And then how did you transition from being abroad to then coming home? Like, what made your final decision to come back to the States as opposed to stay there? Because I'm assuming that you are going back to the same school for next semester, right?
Right.
And now are you going to go back to Spain, or are you just going to keep doing digital school?
Well, like I said, Spain is all about last minute and mañana, so we have no idea what's happening yet. None whatsoever. We have not received one email regarding the upcoming semester and what their plans are for us.
When is it supposed to start?
September.
Okay.
So I guess they feel like we have a lot of time, but it's really not, because if everything needs to be virtual, you need to start putting those systems in place. But again, todo mañana. So I'm not even stressed. So Corona. Okay. So in Spain, the epicenter of the virus in the beginning was in Madrid. We were hearing things about it, but it never sounded like it was that serious, to be honest with you. So to give you some idea about what I mean, I left Spain on Monday, March 16th on a flight that left at 1 p.m. Spain time. And that weekend, that Monday morning, no, that Sunday, I arrived back in Spain from London. So I was in London from the prior Thursday. Flights were still open, flights were still flying. It was as though nothing happened. When I finished class that Thursday, the school had told us everything is normal, don't worry, it's no coronavirus, it's no problem. So I was like, all right, fine, because I wasn't going to fly. I was like, I don't know what's happening, because it started to sound a little bit serious, but then they were like, it's not a problem. It's in Italy. It's in Madrid. It's not here. And so I was like, all right, well, I'm getting on my flight. So got on my flight, went to London, had a blast, party. Saturday afternoon, we get an email saying that the university was closing for 15 days. And I was like, but you just said, and they were like, as per government, whatever, like decree or whatever. So I'm like, oh, same day, I get another message from a friend talking about Trump is closing the borders canceling flights or whatever from EU. And I was like, what, how am I going to get home? So now I'm panicking. I'm like, what is happening? Girl, when I flew back to Barcelona on Sunday morning, it was a ghost town. Everything was closed. Nothing was open. Not even like the little corner store, nothing. And it was like everything shut down. Because on Monday at 8 a.m., they were starting the lockdown. Ooh. And I was like, y'all just said on Thursday it was not a problem. So I actually got home that Sunday. I called KLM because I was having issues trying to book the flight with Diamond because Norwegian wasn't flying dogs. And they weren't flying directly from Barcelona to New York because of the travel ban, the EU travel ban. So I booked my flight. Yeah, I booked my flight with KLM, and they were able to book Diamond in, and then I just left. I just packed a suitcase, packed her up, and then I just kind of left because I was like, I don't know what's going to happen, but if something crazy is going to happen, I want to be home. I don't want to be trapped in this little apartment for the next 6 months.
Right.
So.
Damn. Yeah. And if you're new to travel, the most expensive travel in general, I'd say a strong 85% of the time, the most expensive travel you're going to do is last minute travel. Yes. Y'all.
I paid an arm, a leg, and my firstborn for that flight. I paid a lot of money for that flight. And it's more expensive if you travel one way. So I booked a two-way flight, one leaving in March and coming back in June. And obviously I didn't take the flight in June because we can't fly, but it was to go one way. I remember it was like $1,500 or $1,400. And then to go round trip, it was like $800 and something. So I was like, all right, I'll just pay the $800 and something. And then the extra €200 for Diamond to fly and to hold, and just, you know, everything was expensive. But I was like, listen, I got to get out of here. And yeah, it was fine. But I got the money back from the return flight because it was canceled. KLM canceled it. So I got like $350.
Okay.
So yeah, that was it. Yes, you're right. It was expensive as fuck. Yes.
So it's just a mental note, because this could absolutely be, I guess, an episode for students abroad. Have that coin on hand, if possible, because, again, luxuries, you know what I mean? Like, you don't ever want to have to leave immediately, you know what I mean? Like, you don't ever want to have to make that type of, you know, decision. You don't want to have to make that that flight, that, come on. But it's one of those things to keep in mind should you decide to kind of uproot your life. What is your flexibility look like? What is your flexibility in terms of finances and in terms of just what type of, responsibilities and restrictions you have in place? Like, do you have any medical things in place where you can't necessarily just pick up and fly? Like, for example, Fletcher, one of the guests I had prior, is wheelchair bound. So, you know, there are certain things that you have to consider about your situation that may come as a, not cost restrictive, but may come as a financial burden. Like, Anika had the dog, so she can't, like, just have enough to fly herself home. Like, what you gonna do with your baby?
Right.
You know what I mean? So you gotta keep little things that you may want to say, oh, it's not a big deal. Just consider, if I gotta get back, do I have that rainy day fund, like that emergency fund that you hope you don't need, but you want to be prepared for? So what did you have to leave behind?
Girl, my whole apartment, a whole 2-bedroom apartment. Oof. I had to leave behind. March, when I left, March's rent was already paid. April, I paid, although I wasn't there, but I did inform my landlord that I would not be paying May. Because my contract was up June 4th. My lease was finished June 4th. And I was like, I'm not paying for the last month because I'm not there. And when I did speak to him in April, he was not trying to give me any, you know, like, there was no, like, okay, we'll work with you. Right. No, he gave me a lot of pushback. Like, it was just like, well, you know, too bad. Like, we don't know. And then Spain kept doing this thing where they were like, oh, we're going to just extend the lockdown 5 days and you guys will be free. And they kept doing this thing. And I'm like, y'all not getting free no time soon. And he kept saying, well, we'll see what happens. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to pay, but I'm not paying you for May. And so in May, they did start to lift restrictions where people could move around. And so actually I asked my dog walker if she could pack up my apartment for me. And she was so kind as to do that for me, obviously compensated because that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And again, this goes into how much finances you have. If you have to do things last minute, do you have enough saved to do that? And that's definitely a factor that I considered before I left, because when I lived in Korea, I had to leave. And I think we spoke about this because my mother passed away. Mm-hmm. And so I had to also leave very last minute, and I didn't have the money to leave. And someone actually had to buy my ticket home. And it was the same thing. I left my apartment. I had to get someone to pack it. And so this time around, I definitely budgeted for emergencies because I'm very aware of how it can happen. I got my dog walker to pack my apartment, and I coordinated to have some things moved into storage, like things that I would need when I get another apartment. And then my clothes and shoes and bags, I had them shipped to me. And that was another cost, which there's an amazing company that ships from the UK, France, Spain, and I think Ireland to the US and Mexico. I will give you the link because they're really, really good. They're fast.
Absolutely, we'll put that in the description.
Yeah, my stuff. Yep, it's so good. My stuff got here in 3 days. Ooh. So, yeah, they took it on Friday and it was here by Monday afternoon.
I hear that hot shit.
So, yeah. But it's very expensive. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what other pieces can you leave us with? Like, how can the student experience be appreciated outside of how did you find, like, I guess, like, what did your self-care look like while you were there? Or how did you find ways to, I don't say, like, diminish, but lessen the stress of the energy not being where you needed it to be? Because as a student, like, you already have that cloud of, I've got this test, I've got that. And do you speak Spanish?
Yes.
Okay, so speaking the language wasn't an issue. Were all your classes in English or were they in Spanish?
Some. It was like half and half because there were some professors who didn't have a good command of English, so it just ended up being in Spanish.
Mm. So, right, if that's stressful to some of us.
Right.
That's one thing to consider. Outside of the normal stresses that anyone is going to face as a student, how did you combat in your own way the stress that you were experiencing outside of the student stress?
A lot of exercise, to be honest with you. I got myself into a really nice routine, actually more so in the second semester, because first semester, it was only 3 months, and that seems like a lot of time, but it's not when you're trying to adjust to living in a foreign country and trying to coordinate your entire life so that you can do all these things. So I got into a routine in my second semester, which was great because I didn't have any class on Fridays. And Thursday classes were done. Actually, class every day was done by 1 o'clock. So there was a lot of exercising. There was a lot of working out. And those were huge. I would say they were stress relievers, but more so it was this kind of like feeling like this is mine. I'm doing this for me, for no one else. And then I found something on Pinterest called Savers. I'll send you the link. It's called Savers Mornings.
Okay.
And it's an acronym, and each letter stands for something. So the S is for silence, and this is how you start your mornings. The A is for affirmations. The V is for visualization. The E is for exercise, and exercise can be anything. You can stretch for 3 minutes, and each letter stands for something. And I started going through those things every morning, and it started giving me some grounding. Mm. And it just made me feel like I was ready to take on my day. You know, just I start my morning with silence, with prayer, with affirmations, because some mornings going to some classes, child. I want to jump out the window. But just knowing that I'm grounded, and then kind of like the visualization part, just visualizing my future every morning. Like, what am I doing this for? What do I want out of life? What do I want my future to look like? What am I creating here? Why am I here? And then knowing that I had an amazing person, albeit far away, an amazing person who's just like in my corner. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I started doing. That was self-care. And you know what else I started doing, honey? I started doing my nails and toes every 2 weeks because I was like, I deserve it and I want to look pretty. Right. I want to look pretty. And I built a rapport, and I miss my people at Moo Moo Nails. Yeah, they were so good. But yeah, that was what I was doing. And cooking when I had time. So just basic things that people tell you to do. But when you're home, you don't do it because you already feel comfortable. But when you're somewhere else, it's like, I need to get grounded. I need something to ground me so that I do not forget when it gets hard what I'm doing this for and really who I am in this journey.
I like that. What was your experience with the community like? Because I think that we all know that perceptions matter, although instances shouldn't necessarily they shouldn't really matter in a lot of cases, but it's a thing, right? So for the average student, like you said, they're 17, 20 or whatever. So although we don't look our age, we also don't look 12. We don't look 18. You know what I mean? So the average person looking at you here,
you think it's so funny. I look 12.
It's like you can tell that we're adults, right? So the average person isn't going to look at you and say, "Oh, right. She's here because she's a student." So, do you feel that the community that you found yourself in terms of just going to the grocery store, coming in and out of your building, and just being outside and about in places that weren't student specific, how do you feel like your interactions with the community were?
So, well, where I live specifically, and it's so funny because this is my second time living abroad, and I always end up in immigrant communities without trying to be in these communities. This is just the apartment that I could find because I didn't have any papers when I left.
What's that? And you didn't have any papers.
Well, I didn't have a visa. I didn't have a visa when I left. And as an American citizen, we can go into Schengen countries for 90 days without a visa. But after 90 days, we have to leave. But a lot of times in many countries, you can't rent an apartment without having any sort of visa or, you know, something to show your landlord why you're here, because they could get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so I found someone who was doing short-term rentals, and he was like, okay, but for monthly, this is what I can do for you. And so I lived in a neighborhood called El Raval, and the population in that neighborhood is mostly Bangladesh, people from Morocco, and some Nigerians. Okay. And yeah. And so to be honest with you, living in that neighborhood, and there's a lot of Dominicans there too. So people just thought I was either Dominican or Moroccan. So I never felt like, and I loved my community because there was food. Like, yes. Everywhere. And that is a huge thing for me. And not that the food in Spain is not good. It's nice. But again, as people of color, we like comfort food. You know, we like our stews and our mm-hmm. rices and our beans and our plantains.
And rib stick and food. The shit that's going right. to keep you full. You don't exactly. got to come back for three plates.
Right. Right. And not every day, but just having it available. Mm-hmm. And so where I lived, there were a lot of Bangladeshi restaurants. And there were two Nigerian restaurants, a couple of Moroccan, and there were two Dominican restaurants. And the Dominican restaurant was the first place I went when I got there. I got some rice and beans, and it was so good. So in that specific community, I always kind of really felt at ease and comforted, even though a lot of people were like, ooh, you live in Raval? It's rough. I never felt like it was rough. Yes, right. Yes, people were getting robbed okay. all the time. I'm not going to lie. They do a lot of pickpocketing. I actually got my phone stolen in November oh, when wow. I was in the train station. But to be honest with you, like coming from a place where people shoot up schools, getting my phone stolen in comparison, I'm not really feeling like my life is in danger.
Fair.
Right.
Yeah, basic tour. Like I was in a Facebook group, a travel group, and it's funny because it kind of reminded me that just because you've come to the place where you know certain things doesn't mean that everybody else does, right?
Right.
So there were some women that were expressing concerns about solo travel. And so I'm right. like, all right, well, I do solo travel. Like, what exactly are your concerns? Maybe I could, you know, help you with something, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the young ladies was saying safety. So I said, well, what specifically around safety are you worried with? Like, are you worried right. about, you know, being robbed or assaulted or like, because there's the I don't want to get trafficked. And then there's the I don't want to get, you know, pickpocketed.
My phone taken.
You see what I'm saying? Like, there are different types of safety concerns. And it's kind of like I was waiting for her. Like, I'd asked her a couple of qualifying questions. Like, now, granted, I don't really it's a not iffy area, because at the same time, you don't want to be that one, like, similar to the people that you were speaking of who weren't your tribe. It's just like there's no, well, what did you do to, you know, elicit that behavior from someone? It was more in terms of, are you worried about something that is a concern anywhere you go? Because I'm trying to like point right. out, like, you're being a little like irrational in the sense, because it's hard to tell somebody that they're being irrational without trying to, because it's not that, damn, how do I word it? It's not that it's an irrational fear. It's just that you're amplifying it in this area in particular is where right. I find it irrational. It's like, so where are you from? Like, can you not get pickpocketed in your own neighborhood? Like, can you not get, right. You know, assaulted or accosted on the street where you're from normally? And that's why there's a different, you know, it's like the same sense that you go about life in your everyday life is the same sense I expect that people bring with them when they travel. And it's just like, I don't like not in the sense of victim blaming, but you don't have to, you know, wear the fanny pack that goes under your clothes and just like, you don't have to be like.
In Barcelona, you definitely do. But.
And you know what's funny? Not that it's funny, but I remember that sentiment while I was there, because my experience, contrary to your experience, is that I fucked up. That was another one of the really learning experiences for me, because I stayed. Let me start with my entire trip to Barcelona was $600.66.
Oh, wow. That's
that
amazing.
Included round trip and my accommodations. And where I fucked up at was the place that I stayed advertised that they had an airport shuttle. Which wasn't.
Right.
And no. I'd already booked, and it was one of those things that I did on Expedia, and it was one of those can't cancel it. And when I called to arrange for a pickup, they told me, oh, we don't have one, you have to take a taxi. So that whole trip, I spent maybe $300 in taxis. And so I stayed like an hour. I was in Garagia or something like that. I was like an hour from the airport. And that's why it cost so much. And when I was in actual Barcelona, it's kind of like you come to New York City, but then you stay like in Staten Island.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just like, exactly. I mean, granted, I had a much better view than in Staten Island. Like the mountains were incredible. Like it was beautiful where I was staying, but I didn't get to experience the city except for the couple of hours that I spent after a group tour left from the general area. And a woman that I was there with was actually a dentist. No, her husband was a dentist. Was she a dentist? I think, I don't know, one of them motherfuckers was a dentist.
Everybody was a dentist.
Right? And he was there for, and like, they were there for some type of
conference.
Thank you. Okay. And she was just like, well, I'll see him when I get back. Like, he's at his conference shit, so I'm gonna go do my own thing. And she was telling me that she wasn't new to Barcelona. She'd been there before, and she had also gotten pickpocketed. Like, somebody, like, took her shit, or, like, either they snatched her purse or they took her phone. And that was one time she did get got, and then a second time somebody tried to take her shit, but then, like, they, like, she was able to kind of
fight them off.
Right. Like, they realized she was starting to pay attention to their proximity to her and her shit, and then they kind of didn't follow through.
Oh, right. Okay.
But I was just like, okay, so Brooklyn. Okay, so Bronx. Like, all right, so just keep your shit on you. And it's,
I mean, but at the same time, you can get pickpocketed or robbed anywhere, to be honest.
Exactly.
I think there's a high incidence of it in Barcelona just because there's a high rate of tourism. But like, I'm always, I have a lot of reservations with calling an area rough or dangerous or different things. And this comes obviously from a level of from a level of consciousness about who I am as a person and who my people are. And also as an Airbnb host, I've experienced, you know, I had properties in different neighborhoods. I had properties in Park Slope, Brooklyn, where my reviews were very different from the reviews I got in Flatbush. Mm. And, you know, both spaces were only about 15 minutes from each other, but the apartment in Flatbush was in a building. There were a lot of people of color in that neighborhood. And a lot of times in the reviews, it would be like, oh, this is a really nice place, but the neighborhood was a bit rough.
Right. And is it the neighborhood or the people?
Right. And I actually, on several occasions, you know, I dug deeper, like, well, what made it rough? You know, what exactly specifically did you see that made you feel like your life or your safety was in danger? Because the presence of Black people is not the absence of safety. That's it. Those two things are not synonymous. Right. And so now I'm like, I'm not okay with calling. If I see somebody get shot in front of me, then I'm like, okay, this is rough. But until I see real crime, like I've seen like 3 or 4 pickpocketings happen in my neighborhood, like right around the corner from my house. But this is all over Barcelona. Mm-hmm. This is not just where I live.
Right.
And until I see like heinous crimes happen in front of me, I'm very cautious about referring to a neighborhood, especially one with brown immigrants, as rough.
Right. Like,
that's not okay.
So how did, if any, I guess, research into the neighborhood did you do? Because that's, again, another learning experience. I remember I was going to see a friend in Atlanta. Granted, I've got family in Atlanta, but it was like I wanted to be able to come and go at, you know, whenever I wanted, and for that person to be able to come into the space comfortably as well. And I didn't feel comfortable with this person, you know, being in like my cousin's house. You know what I mean? So it was kind of like, all right, well, I'll look for an Airbnb. Cool. And I also didn't necessarily want to stay at their house. So I'm looking for an Airbnb. And as I'm sending links, they're like, nope. And I'm sending another one. Nope. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with it? Like, I'm looking at it like, all right, it looks nice. And he's just like, no, you don't understand. It's like 10 minutes from my house. I know that house. You don't want to stay there. Or they're showing you the pretty pictures. And that's the only nice house on the block. Or, it's also across the street from an empty lot where the transients kind of congregate. So it's just like there are reasons to look into neighborhoods, or there are, of course, because some people aren't necessarily going to, when you're looking at a listing, if you don't look at the neighborhood the listing is in, you can get yourself in a situation where you're not comfortable. Not to say that you're not safe, but that you're not comfortable. So especially when you're going someplace for much longer than a weekend abroad, or, you know, 8 days in somebody else's area, how, if you did you look into the space that you were going to stay in because you were going to be there for such a long amount of time?
No. I will say the most I did was get the address, Google it, and look at the street view and look at the neighborhood around it. I didn't do much research because, to be honest with you, I didn't have much of a choice. I didn't have a network of people who were going to be able to give me information on how I could rent an apartment without a visa or without it's called a padrón, which is like a certificate, you know, a paper. So I had no choice.
Right.
So it was like, I'm either taking this apartment or I'm living in the auditorium of the school. So yeah, like, I was like, I mean, this is it. Like, I got to take it for now. And, you know, when I got there, I realized, okay, I like this. I really like the neighborhood I lived in, but it was super far from school, which is what I couldn't quite gauge when I was Googling it, because that's what I was mostly concerned about, how far it was. Understand, like, how the train system worked in Barcelona. But basically, where I was at, I had to take the train couple of stops and then transfer to like the equivalent of the Long Island Railroad take that. And so the whole commute to school is like an hour. And I was like, this is too much. So the goal is to move, you know, much closer to the school, but the school is outside of the city center. So.
Okay. So either way, you would likely have a bit of a headache to get there.
Yeah. I'm looking for something that's like 30 minutes, something where I don't have to take two trains, where I could just hop on that Long Island Railroad type train and just go.
Got it.
Yeah.
So what, where can the people find you? Where, can we, follow your travels on your way to fixing people's teeth out here? So question, are you going to be a dentist or an orthodontist?
So people ask me that often, and I often wonder what information is out there about orthodontists.
Let me tell you what my understanding is, and so you could clarify that. So my because I remember I had my wisdom teeth removed, and they said, no, we don't do this in the office. You have to go to an orthodontist. So in my mind, the orthodontist is the one that'll do any surgeries, and your dentist is the one that will do anything kind of minor and like in-house, kind of like a psychiatrist versus a psychologist. Like, I don't know which one can prescribe meds, but I know one can prescribe meds and then one can't. So in my mind, it's just like your internal medicine doctor would be like your dentist versus your surgeon would be your orthodontist. That's what I thought.
So you're almost right. So basically, an orthodontist is a type of dentist. So a general dentist would be like an internal medicine doctor. An orthodontist actually, if you had wisdom teeth extracted, they probably sent you to an oral surgeon.
Okay.
Because an orthodontist does braces.
Ah.
That's orthodontists, they specialize in alignment and, you know, like optimal occlusion, which is like teeth, you know, aligning perfectly. And so there are many different specialties. You know, you have orthodontists, endodontists, they do root canals, oral surgeons, they are the surgeons. They do the surgery, the blood, the fun stuff. Periodontists, they do
gums.
They do gums, yes. They focus mostly on gums and they do a lot of implants. They work with the bone and the gums. So they're all dentists. They're just different specialties. I am absolutely not going to specialize in orthodontics. It is boring. Well, I don't know. It was boring to assist. It might be much more interesting to actually do it. But when I was an assistant and I had to assist in orthodontics, I was like, honey, this is not for me.
Okay.
So I will likely either become a general dentist or I'll go into an oral surgery residency, depending on how my life is looking, if I'm not too old and tired by then. But as a general dentist, you can do pretty much everything. You're not limited in your scope. So that's the good thing about general dentistry.
Oh, so they can perform. What would I'm asking then, as opposed to me assuming.
Okay.
So what would a general dentist do that? Because if they can do a lot of different things, why do they outsource us? Is it that just they in particular don't want to do it at that yeah. office, just like the yeah. licensures and stuff, I guess?
It's not really the licensing. I mean, I know in New York State, it's not so much the licensing. It's more about what they are comfortable with, because a jack of all trades is a master of none, right? So mm-hmm. if you're doing everything, the likelihood of you being good at everything is very low. And a lot of dentists don't want to be bothered with extractions. Braces definitely is a specialty. That's, you have orthodontics, you have to really know, because it requires all types of special equipment.
Got it.
Root canals, they're boring. So a lot of dentists don't want to do them and they take long. So they just outsource. And sometimes they'll do them if they feel like it. It just depends. But as a general dentist, you have the liberty, at least in America, to do the entire scope of work.
Okay, so when you go to get a root canal, that's a regular dentist. They just happen to do root canals, whereas your regular dentist just is the same kind of dentist as the person doing your root canal, per se. They just don't want to do root canals.
Yeah, so when you go to your regular dentist and your dentist outsources the root canal, they're probably sending you to an endodontist who specializes in root canals. An endodontist is still a dentist. They just had more training in that specific area.
Okay. So they're all basically the same. It's just like your pediatrician or your gynecologist or your internal medicine. It's like, we're all doctors. Right.
They just have specialties. And it's like, whatever you're interested in doing, you specialize in it. And general dentists generally do upkeep, maintenance, some cosmetic things.
Cleaning.
Again, I have no desire to do any of that. I just want to yank the teeth out, slice the gums.
Ooh, so that's the, okay. So you would be the dentist that would get the specialty patients, per se.
Yeah, like the surgeries.
As if I'm looking to somebody else, yeah, like, I get it.
Right.
So, Anika, thank you so much for chatting with me. Let the people know where they can find you. How would you like people to reach out to you should they desire?
If they want to reach out to me, they can find me on Facebook. My name, Anika Jacobs. That's A-N-N as in Nancy, EKA Jacobs with an S. And then on Instagram, you can find me at Momonique, and I'll just type it in the messages so you can share that. And that's it. I don't have any... None of these TikToks and Twitters that these kids have.
Sure don't. I have Twitter, but I don't even know if I know the password. Like every time I
same
adventure to it, because I know that Twitter is a place for things. You know, I know that it's great when it's used appropriately. I just don't know how that is anymore. And it just kind of, it's like, I think I follow like 12 people. And I feel like there's so many ads now. Like, they suggest this, and it's just, I'm like, it's like an overload, and I just, it was a fun good 2 minutes. I'm out.
I have a Twitter account, and I literally, ever since they came out with the Citizen app, I don't even go on Twitter no more, because I used to just go on to see, was those gunshots I heard, or was that
fireworks? Oh my gosh, you're one of those? My mama got one. I remember when she first got it, she was like, look, So I'm gonna show you right. these, and I'm like, right. you go. You're not concerned. You nosy because you ain't helping.
Exactly. 100% nosy. 100%. I'm not going outside to do nothing, but I just want to know just in case.
So I cannot go outside when y'all outside.
Right. Exactly.
But thanks so much, Anika. I really appreciate you coming back. And guys, don't forget to like the episode, share the episode, subscribe, all that jazz. Appreciate y'all for coming back. Welcome, and hope to see you guys at the next episode.
Bye. Thank you for having me. Bye, guys. Adios.